From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Deciding whether or not a mother should have custody of her child, suppressing the only evidence that will convict a criminal because it was obtained illegally. These are some of the everyday decisions that can make Judge Robert Satter feel like he's playing God. On today's Fresh Air, Connecticut Superior Court Judge Robert Satter, author of the book Doing Justice, talks about some of his toughest decisions. Also, we talk with short story writer Stephanie Vaughn. Several of her stories are based on her memories of growing up on military bases. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new album by cult star J.J. Cale. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Mountains of the Moon, a new film about an expedition in the 1800s to the source of the Nile. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Senate and White House negotiators announced an agreement on clean air legislation today. NPR's Mara Liasson has details.
After weeks of negotiations behind closed doors, Senate leaders from both parties and administration officials finally hammered out a compromise on a bill that proposes to toughen restrictions on auto emissions, acid rain, cancer-causing toxics, and other sources of urban smog. The compromise was designed to satisfy enough regional and economic interests in the Senate so that a filibuster against the bill could not prevail. And today, as if they were seeking strength in numbers, a score of senators from both parties and from all parts of the country promised they would stick together and support the compromise. They said they would work to defeat any amendment that would unravel the agreement. However, senators who feel the compromise doesn't go far enough to protect the environment or the health of Americans promised they would try to strengthen the bill with amendments when it comes to the floor on Monday. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
A federal grand jury in Dallas today found five so-called skinheads guilty of crimes against minorities. Tracy Tong of member station KERA reports.
The all-white jury deliberated for 4 hours before reaching its verdict. The five young men, ranging in age from 19 to 25, are guilty of conspiring racially motivated hate crimes against Jews, blacks, and Hispanics. The cases go back to 1988, when the five vandalized a Jewish synagogue and harassed blacks and Hispanics at a Dallas park. During the trial, former skinhead members testified that the group, known as the Confederate Hammerheads, also planned to run lethal gas through the air conditioning vents of a Dallas synagogue. Defense attorneys contended their clients were merely exercising free speech. Prosecutors have said this trial is the government's first major assault against white supremacist groups. Sentencing could come later next month. For National Public Radio, this is Tracy Tong in Dallas.
Commentator Andy Rooney will return to the CBS TV show 60 Minutes on Sunday after sitting out less than a month of a three-month suspension. Rooney was suspended without pay for allegedly making racist remarks in an interview with The Advocate, a homosexual newspaper. Rooney's denied making the remarks, and Advocate reporter Chris Bull, who wrote the story, said he didn't tape the interview. Homosexual activists had criticized Rooney for a statement he made in a commentary last year, in which he said that homosexual unions caused premature death. CBS President David Burke said that he'd discussed the allegations, both with Rooney and with black and homosexual organizations. He said it was time for Rooney to return to the television show. CBS says Rooney will discuss the charges on Sunday's program. Prices were higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed more than 8 points, closing at 2,635.59. Advances led declines 4-3. This is NPR News. Exxon Corporation officials confirmed that the president of Exxon Shipping Company handed in his resignation today. A company spokesman says that Frank Iarossi resigned for personal reasons. The move comes 2 days after Exxon Shipping Company and the parent company were indicted by a federal grand jury on 5 counts in connection with the Exxon Valdez oil spill last year in Prince William Sound. Leaders of the East German political coalition, the Alliance for Germany, traveled to Bonn to publish their program for the East German elections to be held on March the 18th. The three-party alliance, which is strongly backed by West German Chancellor Kohl and his Christian Democrat Party, says it wants to achieve unification as soon as possible. Matt Fry in Bonn explains how the alliance plans to accomplish this goal.
The unification of Germany is being accompanied by the unification of the election campaigns in both countries. Politicians from Bonn are glad to find an enthusiastic audience in East Germany, prepared to cheer them in their thousands in cities like Erfurt and Leipzig. Meanwhile, East German politicians try and make the most of their patronage from the West. To such an extent, indeed, that the three parties who make up the right-wing Alliance for Germany came to Bonn today to present their electoral program. Apart from an already much publicized commitment to quick unification and a social market economy, the heads of the three parties, sitting next to their patron, Chancellor Helmut Kohl, gave a clear indication that they want to become part of West Germany through a controversial provision in the West German Constitution. This is Article 23, by which any part of Germany outside the Federal Republic can unilaterally come under the jurisdiction of the West German Constitution.
The BBC's Matt Fry in Bonn. Freezing winds and blizzards battered Europe for a fourth straight day in storms that have taken at least 82 lives. The worst damage so far has been inflicted on Britain, France, and Germany. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Judge Robert Satter says when he was appointed to the bench 15 years ago, new judges were given no training. He received two pieces of advice. Never put your judicial robe over your suit coat, and always go to the bathroom before going on the bench. So he sought the advice of the chief judge, who told him, there are many styles of judging, you'll have to develop your own. Satter's new book, Doing Justice, describes the approach he developed to making decisions that can mean prison or freedom for the defendant. He also writes about the dilemmas he faces on the bench. Satter is a Connecticut Superior Court judge and has presided over all kinds of cases, including rape, robbery, murder, personal injury, divorce, custody, and housing matters. Before becoming a judge, he was a lawyer and a Connecticut state representative. I asked Judge Satter to start with the most difficult decision he's had to make as a judge.
Well, I think the most difficult decision that I've had to make as a judge is the one that I feel that I was playing God more than any other decision, and that is determining whether or not a woman should no longer be the mother of a child. I think that's the most difficult decision. It's the most difficult decision because sentencing, which is difficult, eventually the sentence is going to be over with. Determining the custody of children is also difficult, but the children are going to reach the age of 18 and they're going to determine their own relationship with their parents. But deciding that a woman, and it's almost always a woman, shall no longer be the mother of a child is forever. Of course, there can be an appeal, but the appeal is usually based on the facts and is not very likely to be successful. But that is a decision that lasts forever. And those are the hardest decisions I think a judge has to make, and they're certainly the hardest decisions I feel I have to make.
Do you have a specific example in mind?
Well, there are examples in my book, of course, of a woman who had abused a child, and the child came to the hospital with broken bones and obviously had been seriously hurt by the mother. And then the mother claimed that it was an accident and promised to do better and so forth and so on. And in the end, I felt that the best interest of the child was that the mother should no longer have charge of that child. And in the end, I removed her as the mother of the child. And that was the end of her relationship with that child forever.
You say that a judge really can't second-guess a decision, but how do you prevent yourself from doing that when you're dealing with issues of such consequence?
I think judges do acquire what I mentioned in the book, a bathtub kind of mind. That is, after a case is over, they forget it. They drain the tub and go on to the next case. And they do it so successfully that often I have tried an intense case, and a month later I'll meet the lawyers involved in that case, and I can't even remember the case, because I've had another case after that and another case after that. And you can't live with the possibility of making a mistake, even though undoubtedly we do make mistakes, because there's always another decision to make. And you just steel yourself to go on and make each decision, feeling you're doing your best.
Have you ever, in a criminal case, let someone off who afterwards committed another crime?
Yes. I had a situation quite similar to that. It was a young man had been accused of a crime, and he was before me, and I had to determine bail. And I felt that there was a good prospect that he would appear at the trial, and so I remember setting the bail very, very low. And that young man walked out of the courtroom, walked virtually around the corner and assaulted an elderly woman, broke her arm, mugged her, and was back into court a few days left, that very afternoon, I guess. And I always felt some responsibility for that crime.
Now, how did that affect the next decision that you made? I mean, do you become more conservative in your decision making after you feel that you were too lenient with somebody?
I don't think so. The purpose of bail, which is one of those decisions where a judge's decision can have an immediate outcome, such as a person leaving the courthouse and committing a crime, the purpose of bail is to be assured that the person shall appear in court at the trial date. It's not meant to be punishment for an accused crime. A person hasn't been convicted of a crime at that point. And I think I have tried to keep the purpose of bail in mind when I've said it and not be overly restrictive the next time.
Judge Satter, what did you see differently about the legal system and about the courtroom when you started presiding over the courtroom as a judge?
You mean as opposed to being a lawyer?
As opposed to being a lawyer, yeah. Because you have a very different perspective, I presume, as a judge than you do as a lawyer.
Well, what surprised me the most about being a lawyer, about being a judge, was the loneliness of the job. I mean, I had come out of a law firm and had my friends were my partners. I had associations with my secretaries. There was a conviviality in a law firm's office. When I became a judge, I suddenly found myself extraordinarily isolated. I was assigned to courts, as we are in Connecticut, away from home. An hour's trip often. I didn't know anybody in the town. I went to lunch by myself. I stayed on the bench all day. At the end of the day, I signed warrants or other papers or orders I had to sign. And when I left the courthouse, I had nobody to say goodnight to, drove home alone, and then worked on my opinions in my study at night. And I just felt that I wasn't seeing anybody or talking to anybody. I felt an extraordinary sense of loneliness for a long time, for a couple of years as a judge.
Who can you talk to when you're working on a decision?
Well, sometimes you can talk to a law clerk, but in Connecticut, unfortunately, we don't have individual law clerks for each judge, so that's denied us. Sometimes I talk to a colleague, but colleagues are busy. Quite frankly, the person I talk to more about my agonizing over decisions was my wife. And although she's not a lawyer, she was a scientist, she was a very sensible person, and just talking to her sometimes helped me to resolve a conflict in my mind.
My guest is Judge Robert Satter. He's a judge on the Connecticut Superior Court, and he's just written a book called Doing Justice, A Trial Judge at Work. When you're making a decision, does intuition come into play as much as fact?
Intuition is everything. I mean, the law is a fixed body of knowledge, which can be researched, and often, in fact, in the vast majority of the cases, the answer can be found in the law books, can be found in the precedent of other cases, can be found in other authorities. And that determines our case, our decision. And we don't go beyond that. When the law is fixed in a statute or in a clear precedent from a previously decided case, we accept that and decide decide the case accordingly. But there are many, many types of cases that judges have to decide where the law is a general standard, such as in a custody case, it's the best interest of the child. In a termination of parental rights case, the standard is the same, the best interest of the child. In an equity case, it's just a basic matter of what's fair under the circumstances. Those kinds of cases, the discretion of the judge is extraordinarily broad. They're not fixed by any positive rule of law, but rather by the discretion of the judge, and then his own judgment, his own sense of values, and his own intuition comes to play.
You make the observation that judges, like everyone else, tend to believe members of their social class. How does that affect you on the bench?
Well, it raises what you're raising is the question of the credibility of witnesses and the determination of who is telling the truth on the stand. That is a central question in most cases. The subtext of most trials is the credibility of the witnesses. Most cases involve a conflict of fact as to what happened, and very frequently, two or more witnesses will testify exactly the opposite as to the same event, and their testimony is irreconcilable. You can't reconcile what each of them have said when they've made exactly opposite observations and testimony. Then the issue can only be resolved by the judge deciding whom he believes. And whom he believes is a question of pure intuition and pure guess. Now, it's true, as I mentioned in the book, that judges would tend to believe persons of their own class, somebody who's wearing a tie, somebody whose hair is properly combed, somebody who appears to be articulate, is a person that is convincing, I suspect, to many judges. You must steel against that, and I think judges do try to do that and recognize that you have to hear the evidence and decide from the evidence based upon all of the factors that are involved in determining credibility whom you believe.
Don't people also come to court dressed as middle class as possible in a way to get around that middle class bias?
Yes. By all means. A good lawyer will certainly tell his client to wear a tie, to dress properly.
Let me ask you, the judge always wears the judge's robes. Everybody stands when the judge walks in. Do you think of that as like a holdover from the past, or do you think that formality serves a very important function today?
I do think it serves a very important function. I mean, I know that there's a lot of ceremony attached to it, but ceremony has always been attached to authority. The king in countries which have kings has always had a lot of ceremony attached to the exercise of his power. Judges wear black robes, I think, to imply the impersonality of the law. And I think the formality of requiring people to stand when a judge comes into the room, addressing the judge by his honor or judge, politeness and rigid formalities is on the whole a good thing for our court system. I don't think it gets in the way of the ultimate purpose of finding the truth and rendering a fair decision, but it gives a civility and it gives a feeling of the importance of the matter.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Judge Robert Satter. He's a judge on the Connecticut Superior Court. He's just written a book called Doing Justice, A Trial Judge at Work. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Judge Robert Satter is my guest. Let's talk a little bit about criminal trials. You say that sometimes, as a judge, you learn of a defendant's actual guilt through suppressed evidence, but you still can't treat the trial as a charade. Can you give us an example of a case where you learned of the defendant's guilt through suppressed evidence?
Yes, several, but I'll give you one. A typical situation where a defendant, the accused, has confessed to a crime, but the police had failed to apprise him of his rights before taking his statement, and their failure to do so is a violation of the Miranda rule. Policemen are required to apprise an accused before they take any confession from a person that he has a right to remain silent. In one case I had, the police had failed to do that. The man made a free and open confession. And when a motion was made by the accused attorney to quash that confession, I had to quash it because the police had violated the law in obtaining the admission by him of the crime. So the case went on without that evidence being admitted, and the prosecuting having to prove the man guilty of the crime without the admission by him that he had committed it. And so all along, and I felt there was no doubt that he had given the confession, that it hadn't been coerced, and it was probably accurate. But nevertheless, I tried that case as fairly as I could, even though I felt that the man was guilty.
This was a jury trial?
This was a jury trial.
Now, how did the jury find the defendant?
Well, the police didn't have any other significant evidence, and so the man got off free.
Well, how did you feel about that?
Well, I felt that the system worked. Requiring the police to follow the Miranda rule is an important constitutional principle. If the police made a mistake and the man got off, that's just the way the system worked. And I felt badly that a person committed a crime and gotten away with it, but I would have felt worse if I had not quashed that confession when the police had violated the constitutional principle.
So you think that the price you pay for a fair legal system is that sometimes a guilty person goes free?
Absolutely. That's the risk we take. But the result of it is that police learn their lesson, too, and there are very, very few instances of that nature occur.
How much confidence do you have in the jury system for criminal trials?
For criminal trials, I have complete confidence. I do not second-guess jurors in criminal cases. I honestly believe that they represent the conscience of our community. When they let a person off for a crime, I'm willing to accept it completely. I have had one case where a jury found a man guilty that I honestly thought was not guilty, but that was a question of whom you believe, and they had a right to decide the case the way they did. But on the whole, I have complete confidence in juries in criminal cases, and I would never change that system.
I'm sure you've been in the position where you've been the judge and the lawyer representing the defendant is doing a really poor job. Is there anything you can do in a situation like that?
It is an agonizing situation from a judge's point of view. As a judge, he's supposed to be impartial. He's not supposed to interfere with the adversarial system where each lawyer tries the case on behalf of his client. And when a judge intervenes, he tips the scales, sometimes in favor of the person for whom he's intervening. But you can't resist sometimes asking the critical question that will be of help to one side, mainly to get the evidence out. And there have been occasions when I've done that, and I haven't been sorry for having done it. I never interfere on behalf of in a criminal case, on behalf of the prosecutor. The prosecutor mangles his case. I don't feel that I should intervene, because then it would appear that I'm in leagues with the prosecutor and I'm part of the state apparatus, and that doesn't seem fair. I have intervened on behalf of defendants when I felt that their lawyer did not ask the proper question or wasn't pursuing a line of questioning that I thought was important that he do.
When you sentence somebody in a criminal trial, are you expecting that the sentence will serve as punishment or rehabilitation? Does that matter to you? I mean, do you think of it in either of those terms?
I don't think it's rehabilitation. Our prisons are far from places where there can be any rehabilitation. I sentence people to prison because society expects it, because we don't know what else to do with them, because they've committed a crime and which for which they should be punished. But I just have the gravest doubts of what's served by it. But I do sentence people to prison. I have to. That's the only alternative I have.
Does Connecticut have a terrible overcrowding problem like so many other places do?
Terrible overcrowding problem. At the present time, for every person that's sent to prison each day, somebody has to be let out. The result is that people are now serving one-tenth of the time for which they have been sentenced. The criminal justice system is really breaking down because of the lack of prison cells.
My guest is Judge Robert Satter, and he's a judge on the Connecticut Superior Court. He's just written a book titled Doing Justice, A Trial Judge at Work. The introduction to your new book is written by William Styron, and he talks about something that happened in 1962. The execution was planned of Benjamin Reed, who Styron describes as the quintessential American victim, that is to say that being black, young, and destitute, he represented the individual our society is most likely to put to death as sacrificial atonement for its own failure to achieve the equality proclaimed by its democratic slogans. That's what William Styron writes in the introduction. And you were one of the people who spoke out against the execution of Benjamin Reed. And, in fact, his sentence was commuted. It was changed to life in prison. But then he was paroled. And just days, I believe it was, before he was scheduled to actually get out of prison, he escaped. And I was wondering how you felt when that happened. Here is someone who you stood up in defense of, and just before he was about to get out, he escaped.
He did worse than that. He escaped and he raped a woman. And all of us felt, Styron felt, and I suppose I did too, that he had betrayed us by those actions. I think in retrospect, and almost everybody who know about the case agrees that Ben Reed just was scared stiff of getting out of prison. He had already been in prison about 15 or 16 years, and the thought of getting out seemed to scare him very much. He committed that crime in order to assure he stayed in prison. And he did stay in prison for another 10 years. I represented him as a lawyer at his rape case, and I stayed with him through those 10 years, and eventually he did get out many years later, about 4 or 5 years ago, and he's now living in a city in Massachusetts, and he's doing very well, and he's a completely adjusted citizen. In fact, I took him to a Fenway Park baseball game a year or so ago, and we had an absolutely marvelous time together.
So this was not a case that made you lose faith in people?
It was not a case that made me lose faith in people, but it certainly shook it. I felt very badly when he did what he did, but I didn't give up on him.
Now, you still oppose the death penalty.
I oppose the death penalty very much.
Does that mean you have to exempt yourself from certain cases, or can you still preside over them?
Well, the jury decides the death penalty in Connecticut. That is, the jury decides whether or not a person will be put to death or not. It's a jury decision. It's the only area of the law where the jury actually decides the sentence. But I would have trouble pronouncing the words, and I would disqualify myself from my capital case.
Tell us why you oppose the death penalty.
I oppose the death penalty, one, because I don't think it's effective. I don't think it deters crime. And I oppose it most fundamentally because, as a member of the state, as a member of our society, I don't believe society should kill anybody. I just believe in the sanctity of life, and I don't believe the state should kill anybody. Because when the state kills somebody, it's me killing him.
You mean you as a citizen or you as a judge?
As a citizen, and of course me as a judge, but I would, as I said, I would disqualify myself from a capital case.
Right.
But me as a citizen, I'm assaulted by the notion of my government and my country killing somebody.
Well, Judge Satter, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Jerry.
Judge Robert Satter has been my guest. His new book is called Doing Justice, A Trial Judge at Work. Judge Satter serves on the Connecticut Superior Court. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, singer and actress Annie Ross. She's been singing since the 1940s and is probably best known as a member of Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross. She's also appearing in the upcoming film Basket Case 2. I hope you can join us.
I sat one night right in the middle of my glass of Coca-Cola.
That's so.
I thought how
what
I now
but
get to some biscuits and a slice of gorgonzola.
Oh, oh.
I then felt
what
a twitch,
which
seemed to come from something under my ear.
Here, here.
I wondered if I
was
high or if it was a mere hallucination.
Maybe.
I turned round and found
what
something I thought was merely my imagination.
Maybe.
On my blouse,
a mouse
sat there, and this is what I started to hear. If you want to hear the story of a mouse in all its glory, then I'll tell you all about the time.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. J.J. Cale may be a cult star in the rock world, but he's influenced musicians from Eric Clapton to Randy Newman. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Travelogue, J.J. Cale's first album in 6 years. Sweet Talk is a new collection of short stories. New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani says it marks the debut of a wonderful new writer. Coming up, we meet the writer, Stephanie Vaughn. And film critic Stephen Schiff looks at the new movie by Bob Rafelson, who directed Five Easy Pieces. It's called Mountains of the Moon, and it's about the historic search for the source of the Nile. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. After years of delays and demonstrations, the NRC has granted the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant in New Hampshire a full power license. Supporters of the plant hail the ruling, but opponents vowed to continue the fight to keep Seabrook from operating. Kathy McLaughlin of member station WEVO was in Seabrook today.
Anti-nuclear demonstrators staged a protest outside the south gate of the plant this morning, carrying signs that said, "Stop Seabrook now," and warning, "No evacuation possible." Diane Dunphy, a member of the Anti-Nuclear Clamshell Alliance, said she and others would continue their fight despite today's NRC decision to license the plant.
And hopefully press the issue with elected officials, give support to interveners, and continue the call for a congressional investigation of what has been a sham of a licensing process.
The debate over Seabrook has stretched more than two decades, with the main sticking point being the safe evacuation of the state's densely populated seacoast, where the plant sits. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy McLaughlin in Seabrook, New Hampshire.
Exxon Shipping Company President Frank Iarossi announced his resignation today and denied that it had anything to do with the criminal indictment of Exxon in connection with last year's Alaskan oil spill. Peter Kenyon of Alaska Public Radio reports.
In an interview from Exxon Shipping Company's Houston headquarters, Iarossi said he's resigning to accept a position as chairman of the American Bureau of Shipping, a worldwide ship registry. Iarossi said he was not asked to resign, and it's just a coincidence that the move comes just 2 days after a federal grand jury handed up a 5-count indictment of Exxon Shipping and its parent corporation. The indictment alleges, among other things, that Exxon officials allowed the Exxon Valdez to be operated by people who were incapable of carrying out their duties. Iarossi is president of the company that owns the Exxon Valdez. His resignation takes effect April 1st. Of his time at Exxon Shipping since the Exxon Valdez grounding, Iarossi said, "It's been an interesting 11 months." For National Public Radio, I'm Peter Kenyon in Juneau, Alaska.
NASA officials have announced that the U.S. space shuttle Atlantis will land at Edwards Air Force Base in California this Sunday. The shuttle was launched early yesterday morning at Cape Canaveral and apparently has put a $500 million spy satellite into orbit. The progress of the mission has been largely kept under wraps under a Pentagon-imposed news blackout. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 8 points today to close at 2,635.59 on volume of 157 million shares. Trading was moderate, as advancing issues led decliners by a margin of 4-3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Veteran guitarist and songwriter J.J. Cale has a new album out, his first in 6 years. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Travelogue.
Sometime in the morning, before the break of day, I lose my direction, I can't find my way, I can't find nobody, tell my troubles to you. I guess so sad and lonesome, guess I tell them all to you.
J.J. Cale is influential, as cult stars go. This Tulsa-bred performer has perfected a low-key style that combines sinuous rock guitar lines, a bluesy mood, and a conversational drawl. Lynyrd Skynyrd and Dire Straits' Mark Knopfler have covered his songs, and his vocal style can be heard in singers as various as Leon Redbone and Randy Newman. It's a style that can be heard most clearly echoed by Eric Clapton, who did his best J.J. Cale impersonation in covering two of Cale's own songs, After Midnight and Cocaine. Clapton has been quoted as saying that when he listened to J.J. Cale records, he was impressed by their subtlety, by what wasn't being played.
No time for making a move. No time. No time for hitting my groove. No time. Summer comes and summer gone. When I sing the very sad song, sad as part of all the same. How it long, all our dreams. No time for making no moves. No time.
Cale's backup musicians here are solid old pros. Jim Keltner on drums, James Burton on guitar, Spooner Oldham on keyboards, and Crazy Horse's Tim Drummond on bass. Cale has enlisted these men to make the same sort of record he's been making for 20 years. And by now, Cale's sound is as close to timeless as rock and roll gets.
Meditation, all that jive, taking out the medicine, and just before sunrise, underground tremble, stop it with a dime. Hey girl, call me if you change your mind. I just wanna love you, and that's a fact. I just wanna tell you, when we get back, you're just the kind of woman to a man all night. You're just the kind of woman that's a dynamite. Underground tremble, stop it with a dime.
Cale has turned himself into something of a cliché, the ultimate laid-back rocker spinning lazy-sounding melodies that communicate a breezy sexiness, a macho casualness, and a cool lack of concern over the forward momentum of his career. But that's kind of a sham. The guy has, after all, put out 9 albums, which is a considerable body of work, and Travelogue, 6 years in the making or not, contains a generous 14 songs. And anyway, many people consider his best song his least typical, Going Down, from 1973. Obsessive and delirious, it's one of the least laid-back songs ever made. Cale doesn't hit a high point like that on Travelogue, but he's got a few fine up-tempo songs here.
It's that kind of thing that you... that you do. It's that kind of thing that you... Gone through these changes like Mr. Right. It's that kind of thing, baby. No alibi.
The interesting thing about Travelogue is that it gets much better as it goes along. It starts off with Shanghai, which Cale and or his record company must have thought was the most commercial sounding song on the album. As it turns out, it's the worst.
Take you right down where you don't want to go if you talk too fast and you walk too slow.
Shanghai, Shanghai, here I come from Shanghai, 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 here I come from Shanghai.
I tried to live by the golden rule.
Shanghai turns all of Cale's mannerisms into mindless jauntiness. But as Travelogue proceeds, Cale starts slurring his lyrics more, letting his guitar lines stutter and shake. He's making music for himself, not some idealized mass audience. And by the time you get to the penultimate song on the album, a real humdinger called Humdinger, he's gotten downright weird.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
¶¶
makes me feel like I'm a natural king. Honey, she likes to lick my finger.
This is Fresh Air. Stephanie Vaughan's first book is a collection of short stories called Sweet Talk. New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani says that Vaughan writes stories that are beautifully observed, emotionally vivid pieces of writing. They mark the debut of a wonderful new writer. Most of the stories are about Gemma, a girl growing up on military bases around the country. The first story, Abel Baker Charlie Dog, is about the relationship between Gemma and her father, a career military officer. In this excerpt, the family is having dinner.
"Keep your voice low," my father told me that day as we ate the ruined squash and chicken. "Keep your voice low and you can win any point." We were living in Fort Niagara, a little army post at the juncture of the Niagara River and Lake Ontario. We had been there through the fall and into the winter as my father, who was second in command, waited for his next promotion. "And always speak in sentences," he told me. "You have developed a junior high habit of speaking in fragments. Learn to come to a full stop when you complete an idea. Use semicolons and periods in your speech." My mother put down her fork and knife. Her hands were so thin and light they seemed to pass through the table as she dropped them in her lap. "Zachary, perhaps we could save some of the lecture for dessert," she said.
Was your father like that when you were growing up, in the way he spoke and the way he required you to speak?
Although the character in Abel Baker Charlie Dog is largely an invention, the one part of the story that's borrowed almost shamelessly from my own life are the lectures I received at the dinner table about good grammar and good sentences.
The New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani reviewed your collection of short stories, Sweet Talk, and she praised you for writing dialogue that maps entire lives. Dialogue that reveals the secrets of character and personality. Do you think that in spite of your father's lectures that you were really attuned when you were young to listening to how people spoke?
Probably. I think all of us who grew up in the Army were especially attuned to that because whenever we moved to a new region, especially in the United States, we were hearing English spoken with a different accent, and we almost inevitably acquired that accent quickly in order to fit in. When I lived in Oklahoma, I think I spoke like a person from Oklahoma, and upstate New York like a person from upstate New York. So I was, in one way or another, listening all along.
Now, you grew up on Army bases, and you say you had to, like, learn to speak differently, no matter, you know, depending on which area you were in. What else did you have to do to keep fitting into the different cultures that you moved into? And I should say, you lived in Ohio, New York, Texas, the Philippines, Italy. These are pretty different places.
Well, the clothing was always different, and dance steps were always different. Everything was always different. There was always a child culture or a teen culture already in place when we moved in. And in the instances, especially when we lived in civilian neighborhoods, we used to, all of us, try to remodel ourselves overnight by changing our clothes or practicing in front of a mirror dance steps that we would probably never do in public but would try to learn so that we could do in public, that sort of thing that I think probably all kids do, whether they're in the Army or not.
Did you find Army bases were the same all over, though, inside the base?
In a way, they are. They always have a teen club. They always have a snack bar, a PX, a commissary. The United States, especially when it builds its bases overseas, often does as much as it can to conceal from you that you are no longer living in the United States.
What were the teen clubs like on the bases?
They always had a ping pong table and, and, you know, a not very good sound system. And they had often decorations that no teenager would have painted or wanted to look at, but they had been done by a GI who had been assigned to make teen decorations. I think the teen club that we went to in Italy at Camp Darby, I think, had pictures of elephants on the walls. Maybe the guy who painted it was good with elephants.
Were these always chaperoned, these clubs?
Yes, there was always a sergeant whose job it was to open the teen club for the teenagers and watch us dance and play ping pong and then close it up for us after we left.
In one of your stories, you have a description of an ice storm that just paralyzes the whole area. The whole area is one sheet of ice, except on the army post where you live, which was cleaned up immediately. And you're right, whenever I think of an army post, I think of a place the weather cannot touch for long. Was that a good feeling to have things so under control, or did you yearn for the chaos of the outside world?
Well, it was nice to have the streets cleaned up during an ice storm so you could walk down them, but it is true that it was astounding and bewildering and puzzling in a way. The order of an army post or any military base in some ways doesn't prepare you for the disorder of the world beyond it.
What did your father do in the military?
I have no idea what he did. I don't know what anyone's father ever did in the military. Their work was always a secret. They told us they couldn't tell us anything about it, and they never did. We were living in Italy when the Berlin Wall went up. A jeep arrived at our house at 3 o'clock in the morning to pick up my father, who left with a gun on his hip. The next time we saw him, a week later, he was carrying an M14 rifle into the officers' club and checking it at a gun rack that had suddenly appeared. We learned about the Berlin Wall, though, not from my father, but from the newspapers.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a brother?
I have a brother, and I have a sister.
Did your brother join the military?
Both my brother and my sister joined the military. My brother is a Vietnam veteran, and my sister, who almost made a career of the Army, decided not to, was part of the United Nations multinational force observing the Israeli withdrawal from Egypt.
Now, are you older or younger than
I'm the oldest.
Was there pressure on you to go into the military, too?
No pressure on any of us. I think we were raised so that had any of us chosen the military, we might be somewhat comfortable there, but I didn't choose it.
How did you start writing?
I can't remember a day when I started writing, but I think I started writing when I was writing letters. I started to write very long letters that I would tell stories in order to make my life interesting. I found myself embellishing, and then I found myself lying, and I thought I had inadvertently stumbled into fiction, so I tried to do it more formally.
Who are you writing letters to?
Friends, peers.
These were letters you had to write because you were always moving and leaving your friends behind?
Yes. I mean, I didn't write when I was in high school or even in college, but after college when I wrote to friends who were in other towns.
I see.
I used to write long letters, and so did they. And they always seemed to have very interesting lives, and I always seemed to have a very quiet life, so I would try to make it more interesting by making up details.
Well, before you realized that lying could become an art, were you at all disturbed to see these fabrications that you were sending off to your friends?
They were usually small and harmless, I thought, and they were usually ways of taking something trivial that had happened to me and adding details to it. Rather, I don't think I did any harm to anyone, and so I wasn't deeply alarmed.
Mm-hmm. When you started to write fiction, did you immediately turn to aspects of your childhood growing up on the military base?
Actually, the first story I ever wrote, and you'll understand why it was not published, was about a 19th century dwarf.
why did you write about that?
He was Italian, and I had lived in Italy and was trying to do an Italian story. But really, I have no idea. I think I thought I had to invent a bizarre character in order to write fiction. And so I used to write about people I had nothing in common with and knew nothing about. But it took me a while to realize that there's material wherever you happen to be having lunch, you can find material.
Is there a novel in the works now?
There is.
And what new challenges is that posing for you?
Well, it's interesting to work on a novel. I don't think the novel form is quite so passionate as and intense as the short story form, because it has a bigger canvas, it allows for more complexity and diversity, and it allows you to be very digressive and leisurely at times.
In what way do you think the short story is a more passionate and intense form than the novel?
Well, you have to do a lot of things very quickly. You have to do a lot of things in the short story that you also have to do in the novel. You've got to get characters introduced, and you have to get them moving. They have to do something. You have to get them out of there. You have to bail them out. But you have to do it in a very, very short space. And you have to tonally, I think, sustain an effect over 15 or 20 or 25 or 30, 35 pages. To write a short story. In a novel, you can often have many voices and interchange among voices and so on. So there's a kind of single purpose in a short story and a single voice in a short story that I think gives it its passion.
Are you committed now to living what you think of as an interesting life, or do you just like live your life and not think about that?
Well, I hope my life won't be boring from here on out, but I'm not committed to seeking experiences in order to write about them. I think I'll either invent them or they'll come to me.
Well, Stephanie Vaughan, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Stephanie Vaughan's first collection of short stories, Sweet Talk, is published by Random House. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to let us know what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. Environmental issues today. The Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant, the big New England plant about which there's been so much controversy, has been given the go-ahead to operate at full power. We're going to take a look also at a controversial nuclear power plant in England. And hear about the Clean Air Bill. A compromise has been reached in the Senate, and we'll talk about what that means and what this bill, if it is ever signed into law, might do. We're reviewing The Hunt for Red October, the movie, and talking to the author of the book about the incident which inspired it.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new movie, Mountains of the Moon, is an historical adventure film based on the lives of two explorers who searched for the source of the Nile in the mid-1800s. The film's directed by Bob Rafelson, who also made Five Easy Pieces, The King of Marvin Gardens, and Black Widow. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
In Mountains of the Moon, there's an African tribe that blesses visitors by spitting milk at them. There's a slave who wears earrings made out of shriveled human ears, which help him listen to the voices of the dead. There's an African tribal king who greets his first Englishman by sniffing him all over like a dog. Meanwhile, he picks his teeth with the tooth of a lion. In short, a lot of Mountains of the Moon functions exactly the way a good adventure movie should. It makes your jaw drop. In telling the story of the great 19th century British explorer Richard Burton and his friendship and rivalry with that other British explorer John Hanning Speke, the director Bob Rafelson conjures up an Africa that's raw and authentic and scary. The sense of isolation and danger can seem overwhelming. In this scene, for instance, the inexperienced John Speke and the expedition leader Richard Burton sit around a lonely campfire somewhere in the middle of the East African night, struggling to diagnose the dangers around them.
Some strange tribesmen followed me as I walked back to camp.
What did they look like?
I couldn't see clearly.
Did they carry lances? Were their faces painted?
Well, they kept their distance.
Understand, Lieutenant. A close observation is not only part of your duty. An Afrika means survival.
We don't look particularly threatening.
You look what you are. White and an intruder.
A moment later, the campsite is attacked by ferocious tribesmen who shoot a spear through Burton's cheeks and tie Speak to stakes and stab at his legs. That may not sound like the beginning of a beautiful friendship. But no sooner do Speak and Burton return to England than they set off together again, this time on a search for the source of the Nile. Almost everything that happens to them along the way has real adventure movie magic. And yet, Mountains of the Moon winds up feeling strangely limp. Is it the acting? Partly. Patrick Bergen is dashing enough to play Burton, but he never convinces you that there's a heart and mind pulsing under his grizzled good looks. Burton was one of the most flamboyant and magnetic figures of the Victorian intellectual milieu, and Bergen can't muster Burton's teeming inner energy. Ian Glen, who plays the stolid aristocratic Speak, is more resourceful, and he often seems to be indicating some vast inner conflict. Could it be, homosexuality? Well, yes, the film hints. In one scene, Burton is wounded and unconscious, and Speak kisses him full on the mouth. But the movie never seems quite willing to let these feelings break out into the open and have their consequences. And later, when Speak betrays Burton back in London, the sexual component of that betrayal is never addressed. Rafelson and his co-writer, William Harrison, can't seem to get below the surface of their extraordinary characters. And as a piece of storytelling, Mountains of the Moon is annoyingly sketchy. Scenes start up, shudder to a halt, and then evaporate without leading to anything. So the movie never builds or flows. It's like a scattered collection of diary entries. Or, more probably, like a movie that should have been 3.5 hours long and has been chopped to smithereens. Then, too, Mountains of the Moon suffers from bad timing. After all, it was scarcely more than a year ago that Lawrence of Arabia was re-released, to remind a forgetful world what an adventure movie can be.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Annie Ross is best known for her work with the jazz vocal trio Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross. On the next Fresh Air, she fills us in on her life before and after Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross. Also, rock historian Ed Ward reflects on the rise to fame and recent suicide of singer Del Shannon. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.